It's time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Stephen Thompson. On this week's show, we'll discuss Difficult People, or to be more specific, the new Hulu comedy series by that name. Then we'll take a figurative journey over to the humble and not-so-humble amusement park, theme parks, water parks, carnivals, and so much more. And as always, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week. So stick around.
Summer is almost over and great music is in the air. All Songs Considered is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Each week, Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best of the best new and upcoming music with lots of songs you'll fall in love with. Find new All Songs episodes every Tuesday at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.
Before we get things started here in historic Studio 44, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Gene Demby, how about you?
I'm the lead blogger for NPR's Code Switch.
Now, we don't have Linda Holmes on the phone this week. She is still in L.A. for the Television Critics Association press tour, but we do have what I consider the next best thing, Margaret H. Willison. Tell us about yourself.
I am a librarian for Love and Money and for Love Alone. I'm like professionally affable on Twitter, and I run a newsletter with a friend called Tuasi Dames.
Nice. Okay, so last week, Hulu unveiled its latest foray into original programming, dropping only 2 episodes of its new half-hour comedy, Difficult People. Now, unlike shows on Netflix or Amazon Prime or other similar providers, Hulu will release new episodes weekly instead of all at once, so we've each seen only 2 episodes of Difficult People. No binge-watching has been done, but we've seen it enough to form what I'm guessing will be some strong opinions. The show itself stars Julie Klausner and Billy Eichner as difficult people. They're struggling comedians in New York City who essentially hate everything except each other. Glenn, does that start to sum it up? This show has a lot of people you love in it.
It has a lot of people I love. It also the cast also includes James Urbaniak and Andrea Martin, so it's just fantastic. I am in the tank for both of these lead performers. Mm-hmm. Just going to say that out here at the outset. I am a fan of Julie Klausner's podcast, How Was Your Week? And there is nothing funnier to me than watching Billy Eichner yell at terrified tourists about Meryl Streep. So I'm in. So this thing, these are my people. This is my show. I'm going to wait to hear your wrong reaction. And then we'll come back to me.
All right. We'll get there. Gene Demby, give me your take on Difficult People.
I actually like both of those performers quite a bit, too, which is why I was surprised at how much I did not like this show. So there's, like, this school of comedy. I mean, we see a lot of this now. You got your Amy Schumers, your Sarah Silvermans, I guess, like, your Chelsea Peretti is sort of in this genre of, I don't know why I'm thinking of women. I'm sure there are men who fit this bill, too.
Oh, sure.
Sort of, like, I'm saying this really inappropriate, like, uncivil thing to people, to strangers, that kind of comedy. Like, but usually part of those characters is that they're like they're doing them in a stand-up routine, and you're supposed to get that there's like some ironic distance between the thing that they're saying and like who the person actually is, right? So you understand that like Sarah Silverman is saying these things, but she doesn't actually think these things,
right?
But in the context of the show, we have two people who are horrible people. Like, I mean, in New York City, you come across these people on the train and you like want to run away from these encounters really quickly. But then after the encounter, you like want bad things to happen to them, and you conjure up ways like, oh, what is the worst thing that can happen to these people? Like, these are the people you encounter.
That's the show you want to see.
I mean, I think the show is sort of asking you like, hey, wouldn't it be cool to sit with these people for 30 minutes at a time? And actually it's not. It's actually really like, I want to push them down a flight of stairs. And so I know we're not supposed to like them, but I also feel like we should care about them a little, but I don't know if I do.
All right, Margaret?
I'm more in Glenn's side of things, and I definitely see where Gene is coming from, where he's talking about the kind of people they are. And I guess to me, it just feels like there are two people who conduct themselves at all times like the human being you are 8 hours into a conversation with your best friend, where you don't need to pretend to be
a nice
any
person.
Better or any kinder than you are on your worst day, and you can just be as nakedly and pettily judgmental as, at least if you're Glenn and myself, like a tiny part of your brain is at all times. Mm-hmm. So for me, you know, as somebody who really presents a very nice face to the world, right. It's great to sort of see my id just unleashed on the world. And I, too, am a big fan of Julie Klausner. Less mileage with Billy Eichner, but I love Julie's podcast, How Was Your Week? And this dramatizes a lot of, or plays with a lot of material you see in there. So it's kind of like sitting down and watching TV show about a friend's life. And that's pretty enjoyable for me.
This is fascinating because when I think about personality types, I situate Glenn and Margaret, as much as they are friends, as much as they are both my friends, I situate them at different ends of some sort of misanthropy spectrum. And it's not that I've never heard Margaret say misanthropic things. It's certainly not that I've never seen Glenn be warm and kind. Mm-hmm. I told you I wouldn't tell anybody about that. But it's interesting that you both have the same reaction. I have some of the same thing that Gene did. I like mm-hmm. these people. I like Julie Klausner's work. I like Billy Eichner's work. I enjoy him as Craig on Parks and Recreation.
Yeah, he's great in that.
So I go into this show like, okay, here are performers I like, performing with performers I like. But there are several different ways to do a show about fundamentally unlikable people mm-hmm. having fundamentally misanthropic opinions. You can go the Curb Your Enthusiasm route, where you have him being misanthropic, but surrounded by, like, you know, his wife on that show is just a, you know, she has her quirks, but is largely, she's in the right, you like her, you root for her. He's a misanthrope bouncing off of, in some cases, rotten jerks, but in some cases, really nice people that he just screws up around. Then you've got the kind of Seinfeld approach where they're kind of misanthropic, they're kind of jerks, but they're sort of lovable at the heart of it, mm-hmm. and they're goofy, mm-hmm. and there's this wide range of interactions. With this, the apparent mindset of the show is these are misanthropic jerks surrounded by an awful, awful world full of awful people who are also jerks.
Okay. Let me pick up on something there, because the show that this is getting compared to is Seinfeld. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I think what I pick up in Seinfeld is what you could call those four characters' sense of complacency, their confidence. If you're being unkind, you would call it arrogance. Mm-hmm. They're always in the right. The world around them is wrong. That's something that the show reinforces. And Larry David does the same thing. Curb Your Enthusiasm does the same thing. He's convinced of his rightness. The world around him is wrong. It's very obvious to me that this show has a woman's sensibility, mm-hmm. a gay man's sensibility, mm-hmm. where it is not that same sense of entitlement. It's about, desperation is the wrong word, striving. Mm-hmm. It's about having to fight for things. And what it is undercut with, maybe this is subtle, it didn't strike me as subtle at all, was a sense of self-hatred, mm-hmm. a sort of self-lacerating mm-hmm. quality.
This is why we fail.
Right, right. And it gets softened in surprising places. I went into the show thinking it was going to be burn the ground, you know, whatever. We hate everything. We hate everybody. Because that's how it's being marketed. Oh, my right. gosh. Wait till you see what they say to some people. Mm-hmm. And it actually is surprisingly more gentle than I thought it was going to be, because we see how much she depends upon her mother. Mm-hmm. That relationship is the only person that she's actually worried about getting approval from, if mm-hmm. not from Billy. And Billy has this, in the second episode, has this thing where he's trying to be friends with people at the diner.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily come out in the pilot, but it's something mm-hmm. interesting. I just think that there's a different... I think Sex and the City dealt with some of the same things with, you know, women and gay men in the city having to deal with the life. But what Sex and the City didn't understand is that those were horrible people.
Yeah, they were objectively venal monsters.
It put
and
them
also,
out there.
How to make jokes more sophisticated than, like, bad puns.
Exactly. Right. It thought that Carrie was cool and yeah. nice, and ugh. She was horrible.
She was unbearable.
This show understands that these people are horrible, and it owns it, and it embraces it. And I'm a little surprised to hear you guys say you like Julie Klausner, you don't like the show. This show is Julie Klausner. Things that she has talked about on the podcast show up on the show, direct, mm-hmm. like lifted whole and placed in there. So this sensibility is kind of her thing, and it feels to me like an authentic artistic expression from her.
Well, yeah. I do think that there are some format issues then. Like, I think she works really well in short misanthropic bursts that show up on your Twitter feed, and that doesn't always translate necessarily into a more fleshed out plots.
You know, I took a while to really grow into my love of Julie Klausner. So her podcast is like a 15 to 40 minute monologue and then an interview with a person. And I was initially hooked in because she was interviewing people I really cared about. And I would skip the monologue and go straight to the interview and listen to that. And then I found that I liked her so much in conversation that I wanted to spend that extra 15 to 40 minutes. Mm. And she's abrasive, you know, like she's tough. And a lot of the ways that she's misanthropic don't necessarily always line up with the way I am, or there are ways I wrestle with it. But the more time you spend in her company, the more aligned to her worldview you become. And then just the more like warmth you find in it, sort of hidden in places.
Yep.
I think that my experience of the show might actually have been improved because I accidentally watched the second episode first.
Ooh,
and I think it's much stronger.
That would change my, yes, yeah, I agree completely.
I totally agree.
Because in the second episode, you know, Jean or Steven, I can't remember which one of you said that all the other characters seem like idiots. That's so true in the first episode, and that's much less true in the second episode. In the second episode, you have Billy having that really weird and funny interaction with the woman he's auditioning for, where at the end of a very bad audition, he manages to guilt her into giving him a callback, and then they have this brief exchange about, like, the Vlasic pickle guy and how she's trying to get pregnant, and it's so funny, each of them stepping out of their prescribed roles and realizing they're both weird people and having a weird person moment. I would love to see more of that kind of thing going forward and less of the stuff where they're giving us just like such an obvious punching bag, like a self-righteous mom who names her kids something like Memphis and Maverick.
Mm-hmm. I do want to agree with Margaret on the point of thinking that the second episode is considerably better than the first.
Yep.
And by the end of the second episode, I was like, they wind it up in a clever way that's kind of wrapping a little bit of a bow on it. And they are coming through having kind of learned something. Like, not necessarily like in that bad way that you're like, oh, they've learned the one to grow on. but I kind of found myself coming around on the show a little bit by the end of the second episode. And what I want to ask is this show being done a disservice by being released like in little doses compared to a binge? I wouldn't want to binge this show, but if you do, it's weird on Hulu to like wait for the release of a new thing.
It is weird. It's kind of halfway between the old model and the new model, where it's once a week.
Right? And this is, are they doing two episodes once a week?
Two episodes a week, yeah.
I mean, pilots are always so rough, right? I mean, I was like, okay, I'll give, the first episode may have been just really like drinking lemon juice. But like the second episode, the lemon juice was not cut that much, right, for me. and so I think you're right. I think maybe if you got to see them, like, okay, if there were five episodes available, or I don't know how long the season will be, 13, I probably would have like powered through the first four just to give it a fair show, like a fair airing.
On our podcast this week, Julie Klausner basically gives a director's commentary, a writer's commentary on these first episodes live. She basically watches it and comments. And many of these comments are, I hate the way my arms look in this scene. But many of them are about the details of the production, whose joke is whose. And she also talks about how that second episode was produced later, and it was moved to the front because they know it's good, and they want people to see it.
Well, she does talk about, for example, the pilot episode was filmed very piecemeal. So there were portions of it that were filmed like a year earlier than other parts of it, and then it was kind of all assembled. So I feel like that can also speak to some tonal unsoundness in that first episode.
Sure.
And this is definitely a show where, like, if the tone is not laser focused, it gets going to be, it's like the difference between drinking like lemon juice from concentrate or like artisanal Meyer lemon juice your friend just squeezed for you. Like, they're going to be tart either way, but one is going to have a little bit more nuance to it.
The other thing that she mentions in the podcast is that as the season goes on, we come to realize that Billy and Julie are each other's only friends. Mm-hmm. So this idea of Billy trying to make friends with other people, that kind of goes away because they realize that only each other would be able to put up with each other.
And I always love shows that like sort of center the friendship more than like the other stuff. Like, I mean, Broad City is like this, like the friendship is like central to like, it is the most important relationship in the show. Mm-hmm. Like, even if they date other people, it's clear that like Abby and Alana are like best friends, and that's the central relationship.
And everyone else is secondary.
Right. And in this show, it's clear that like her partner, whatever the relationship, I don't know if they're married or not, like, is just a tertiary. Mm-hmm. I mean, he just sort of like pops up.
And he's another, so far, I think, poorly defined type. Mm-hmm. It's kind of their view of what NPR must be like.
Yeah. Well, technically PBS, but yes. That's his character, PBS guy.
All right. Well, we'd love to hear where you come down on Difficult People. We'd love to hear your thoughts at home. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH. We will be right back.
Support for this podcast comes from the new Starz original comedy Blunt Talk, starring Patrick Stewart as Walter Blunt, a British import intent on conquering the world of American cable news. That is, if network bosses, a dysfunctional news staff, and misguided decision-making don't derail his mission first. Don't miss the series premiere Saturday, August 22nd, only on Starz.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. For our next topic, we're going to talk about a form of entertainment I don't think we've ever fully addressed in 5 years of doing this show. Amusement parks, theme parks, carnivals, water parks, outdoor entertainment extravaganzas of all stripes. And as tempted as I am to begin with Glenn again, I am going to go with another easily sun-damaged person on our panel and ask Margaret H. Willison. Margaret, are you an amusement park fan?
I am. I'm an amusement park fan.
Okay, so next
team. Know where this is going.
But I'm not a theme park person. I have very limited experience with theme parks because my mom, they were like one of the many things that she took like an impassioned stance against. Hmm. It was like that and the Girl Scouts, which she thought of as a paramilitary organization.
Wait, can you just pause and explain this a little bit? I'm curious.
I think it was mostly just like a knee-jerk hatred of Disney.
Ah, okay.
Just, I think, basically, like, large, tentacled, evil corporation, which she felt very insidious and creepy, so she just would not take us to Disneyland or Disney World. So I didn't go until I was 10, and when I went as a 10-year-old, I went with a 6-year-old, so my primary experience of it was just riding Mr. Toad's Wild Ride over and over and over again. Huh. And also having the mom that I was there with be, like, very anxious about my easily burned skin.
Sure.
And, like, keep trying to make me wear, like, long-sleeved T-shirts in Florida in July.
Mm-hmm. Oh, wow.
But amusement parks are great. So theme parks, not sure. Amusement parks, two thumbs up.
What's your perfect amusement park experience?
My perfect amusement park experience is probably Kennywood Amusement Park outside of Pittsburgh, which is where I went summers as a kid. And
Kennywood?
Kennywood.
Is that like Dollywood, but for Kenny Rogers?
I mean, Dollywood would be my real perfect.
Sure.
Perfect theme park experience. That's like number one on the list of things in America I need to visit. But no, Kennywood, and it would be like you eat garbagey food that's really delicious, and then you go on that swing ride that's on the cover of Dave Matthews' Under the Table in Dreaming, where you like start down at the ground and then the swings go up into the air and you tilt different directions. And probably I would have like a bold friend who would talk me into going on one of the roller coasters because it's not something I naturally gravitate towards, but I'm very susceptible to peer pressure.
So you're not a roller coaster person?
I was when I was very small. And then I went on one of those roller coasters that's a double bump where like the second time you go over the bump, you jump up in the air. And my seatbelt was not appropriately fastened.
Oh.
And I was in there. I was like 47 pounds in there with my like 72-pound older brother. And I just almost flew out of the thing.
Oh,
and that was a real turning point for me in roller coasters.
Wow. All right. All right.
But after seeing a knife thrower at Coney Island last year, my friend John managed to talk me into going onto the Cyclone, which is the crazy upside-downy one
sure.
that the minor league baseball team is named after, at like 12:30 at night. And I can't say that I would ever do it again, but I'm glad I did it that one time.
Wow. All right. So it was a thrill ride. Like a literal thrill ride.
Right.
All right, Gene, how about you?
I just want a second. Coney Island is like an amazing place.
Correct.
But it is not like a fun place to get on rides because it feels like a permanent carnival. It feels like everything is really shoddily put together. you're on the big wooden roller coaster that's been there for like literally like 100 years.
Right.
And it feels like it's been there for 100 years. So like, it's like, it's really like, it just it's a pain, like literally a painful experience.
Yeah, and that's been my experience with wooden ones too.
Might have been mildly duct taped when I was on it.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like. It's funny that you don't like roller coasters because that's always the thing. Like as I've gotten older, it's like my interest in amusement parks is just narrowed to the roller coasters, which means that you're basically standing in line for like 8 hours.
It becomes line land.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, you're not having any. It's like punctuated by funnel cake every now and again.
Yeah.
So like you're like in lines all day.
Replace every now and again with the entire day.
And right.
You've got my experience.
And I just remember having a lot of fun in amusement parks, but like as I get older, I don't have like a cohort of people who like are willing to like sit in the lines all day. And I guess Glenn and Linda and I all grew up in the Northeast Corridor, so we probably have a lot of the same amusement parks in common. Dorney Park and Clementon Park and Great Adventure. And Great Adventure was like always my favorite, but it was Like, it was always in, like, this perpetual arms race with I don't know who, but it was always, like, every year was, like, a new roller coaster. And so, like,
probably with Kennywood.
Probably with Kenny, right? Kennywood. With no one, it's an arms race and no one knew.
Because they want to be, like, largest theme park in Pennsylvania.
Exactly.
They're hundreds of miles apart and nobody knows
no
about
one knows
both.
About the other ones. Every 2 years, there was, like, a brand new roller coaster. And so if you had to, like, sort of skip around the park and stand in line all day, which wasn't fun. I mean, that part of it wasn't fun. But, like, being with your friends and being on the roller coaster was always, like, you know, the 45 seconds of the actual ride, it was always amazing. And, like, I actually am trying to get my girlfriend to go to an amusement park with me. I think we would kill each other before the end of the day, you know, because it's just too much standing around and, like, in the sun.
It's just too much shared time baking under the sun. Yeah, I could see how that would be a stealth, stressful thing. Mm-hmm. I had a similar experience taking my kids to Hershey Park.
Oh, Hershey Park.
A few years ago. Mm-hmm. Speaking of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, the great theme parks of Pennsylvania.
And it was one of those things where they complained the entire time until the drive home, at which point they were pestering me, when can we go to Hershey Park again?
God.
All right, Glenn, hit me up with your thoughts on amusement parks.
Well, I mean, I thought I didn't have much experience, but then I kind of totted it up. And so Walt Disney World twice,
wow.
Great Adventure twice, King's Dominion, Dutch Wonderland.
Which,
spoiler,
that's a deep cut.
Is neither Dutch nor Wonderland. Hershey Park, Sesame Place, Gene.
Yes.
Sesame Place.
Wow.
The Johnson County Fair, which is outside of Iowa City. Tetanus Palooza, that thing. That was terrifying. And the Lenape Fair, which is outside of Westchester, Pennsylvania. And
wow, your parents loved you a lot.
Well, they would just grab us and take us. In the mid-80s, as a snot-nosed teen, I and two friends went down to Disney World and decided we would get on every single ride. And I thought, on the trip down, that we were going, ironically, turns out, an hour into this experience, it's like, oh, no. Okay, you were the only one doing it, ironically. So
wait,
how long
Glenn
were you
Weldon
there?
Story.
We were there for a week, and so we made it to everyone but one. The one that got away was the Diamond Horseshoe Review, which was just an Old West stage show. Not really a ride, per se, but it's still counted.
it's your white whale.
The Diamond Horseshoe Review is now a sandwich shop in Disney World.
Oh,
they closed down a thing. My favorite was the Enchanted Tiki Room. You guys remember the Enchanted Tiki Room? I think it's still there. In the mid-80s, the script from 1960-whatever had not been changed. And, you know, the Enchanted Tiki Room is this just bunch of bird puppets that sing. Mm-hmm. It started off by some hapless Disney worker who goes up to this bird and pokes it with a stick and says, Jose, wake up. It's time to start the show. There's a beautiful woman here, because the recording has him start with, ah, buenos dias, señorita.
So wait. So it's
traffic's in broad ethnic
broad
stereotypes.
They don't line up because it's a tiki room.
Yeah. Although there's also, of course, a German one and a belligerent Irish one. And it was nice, you know,
sure.
This is the kind of Mad Men racism everybody has, right? 1962. But my favorite thing was always that interaction between the hapless kid who had to do the thing. And this also is on the safari. If you go on the safari in Disney World, it's the same thing where they're just kind of reading from the script very listlessly. Unless you get the gay kid. The gay kid's into it. The gay kid. You want the gay kid tour guide, because will give you an experience.
Suppose always. You can't really request that specifically.
You can't. But Epcot is horrible. Epcot is boring. If you go there at 16, I haven't been back because it was homework the ride. It was let's take all the thrilling adventure of a social studies film strip and put it into and let you walk around it. It was awful.
Wow. All right. My theme park experience tends to revolve around the town in Wisconsin. Perhaps you know where I'm going with this, Wisconsin Dells.
Sure.
And Wisconsin Dells tries to fit kind of every sort of theme park experience into this one little, obviously very touristy town. And it's a town that mostly shuts down in the brutal Wisconsin winter months. They've more recently added, like, year-round amusement parks situated within hotels, like complete with gigantic water slides, which, if you don't think about the massive waste of resources, is for me the perfect full amusement park experience, because you have the water slides and the without the horrible sun beating down on
our natural enemies.
And if it's literally like 2 degrees outside and you get to go on a water slide, it's pretty neat. But Wisconsin Dells also has these wonderfully C and D and E list attractions, some of which may or may not like still be there. I know they've closed Xanadu, House of the Future, like Tommy Bartlett's Robot World.
Sure.
If there's a crumbling attraction and downtown they sell taffy, I am in.
Mm-hmm.
So I love the more kind of crude, not crude like filthy sense of humor, but like just the more run down an amusement park is, the happier I am. The smaller it is, the happier I am. The more they sell funnel cakes and like deep fried Oreo cookies, like deep fried butter. They somehow find a way to deep fry butter. They sprinkle powdered sugar on it, and you walk around games of chance. I enjoy being around games of chance. I enjoy, like, if you can win a mirror and it has the band and the band Rat is on the mirror, I am happy. Like, I think one of the reasons for that, I actually did a column, like the music advice column I do, The Good Listener. Somebody wrote in to ask, like, why has the music at amusement park remained unchanged for 30 years? Like, why do I go to an amusement park and I hear the same REO Speedwagon song that I heard at the amusement park 30 years ago? And I theorized, and I feel this way, I think about amusement parks in general, that they do that because that's your youth. That's what the amusement park is there for. It is there to provide sense memories from your youth, to make you feel young again, so that you share your youth with your kids who don't know from REO Speedwagon, so it doesn't matter to them. And I think there's something to that, and I think there's something to why I gravitate to what I gravitate to. My parents took me when I was like 4 to Disneyland and also the Universal Studios lot. They had some like media passes or something to like an early launch of the Jaws ride. And we hadn't seen Jaws yet. It was, or at least
that's,
I mean, maybe,
be a
maybe
tough sell.
I mean, I certainly hadn't. Maybe my parents had. But my father had me sit on his knee. In my memory, I'm dangling over the side of this ride. I'm sure that I'm inside the ride safely. But of course, the Jaws ride entails going through like a bog, and then all of a sudden, a giant animatronic shark leaps out and snaps at your 4-year-old self, scaring the unholy crap out of you and making you scared of sharks to this day.
Yeah.
So like, I don't necessarily have the fond, warm sense memories about 4-year-old Steven going to Universal Studios, but I have lots of fond memories as a teenager going to like dumbass corn roasts and carnivals and getting deep fried cheese.
Well, I figured this topic would be A, kind of loose, and B,
ill-defined.
And that we would all at some point share childhood traumas. For senior week, East High School went to Great Adventure, and it's just the entire senior class, and we're there on the ride, and everybody's going on the Buccaneer. Do you know the Buccaneer, James?
Is that the big ship that goes back and forth?
The ship that goes back and forth on a big parabola. And then when you have high school snot-nosed teens...
Literally snot-nosed, I think this is where this is going.
Goes up so that the people on the bow are in the bottom, right? Directly underneath the people on the stern.
Was it Spit? Right?
Probably.
Sure. The ride should then be just called Spit and Pennies, because it's just descending... It was an unending. It was like something out of a Corel. It's awful. So yes, I don't have fond memories of that. That's why I liked the Enchanted Tiki Room, where you go and sit and watch puppets.
See, and I can get down with more the sitting around watching puppets. Like, I still love going to Chuck E. Cheese. Long past my kids being tired of Chuck E. Cheese, because I could sit and watch animatronic robots all day long.
And I went to Epcot when it had just opened, and I was a kid, so I couldn't drink. The thing I like about Epcot, in theory anyway, it's like this little pressure valve for ugly Americans, where we can pretend. There's this one section where you go around the water, and you just hit little different countries, and you can drink in all those countries. And you can be a belligerent, drunk, loud American, but not in front of actual people in other countries, just in front of Floridians. So I think that's good. It's like a little thing that we've given ourselves to allow ourselves to be jerks.
Is this pre-Captain EO or...?
Yes, it was pre-Captain EO.
Okay.
Yeah, didn't see that. Margaret, you mentioned Mr. Toad's Wild Ride. I love that. When we were snot-nosed punks at 16, we would go into Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, and you could get out of the car and walk around Mr. Toad's Land of Whimsy. In Peter Pan's Flight, enters Neverland, and your gondola goes up against the wall where there is a platform with steps leading down. You can get out of that, go down into Neverland, run through it, and then on the other side of the room, get back up the stairs onto another platform and get back in your chair. You couldn't do that in the Haunted Mansion because there were cameras everywhere and they would stop the ride dead, but in those two rides, you could do it. And when I say we did it, I was a rule follower. terrified of getting in trouble, so I would watch them every time because we went on that ride, those rides several times, and I would watch them run through Neverland without a care in the world, like lost boys.
I was going to ask you how you figured out that some of them had cameras. Like, obviously, this was like a trial and error thing.
Yes, yes, okay, obviously. Okay. You could do it. You could do it. Mr. Toad was golden because nobody cared. but yeah, I couldn't do it in the Haunted Mansion. No way.
Yeah, by the time I visited in 1995, I do not think that was still true.
For me, I think my favorite amusement park experience now is going in as amusement park dad. Mm-hmm. And each of those words should be upcapped at the beginning. I am now amusement park dad. Mm-hmm. So my role is to, like, get the family on, like, the tram that just glides you around Hershey Park, and then to tell my kids that this is secretly a ride called the Devastator, and that at any moment we would be plunging into a giant pit. And so like, every, like, about the, like, 14th or 15th time that I yelled the words the Devastator, I've truly crossed over into being amusement park dad.
Yeah. What happens nowadays with cell phones and log flumes? Because there were some rides back in the day where you're going to get wet.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Now, if you get wet, you are out $200.
I think it's lockers now. I think they have banks of lockers, primarily probably for people's cell phones.
That makes sense. Mm.
But then you're, like, in line without a cell phone for 2 hours.
Oh, my God.
The humanity. All right. Well, I am guessing that people at home have, maybe they can answer that question for sure, because it's been a few years since I've been to an amusement park with that much water. But if you've got thoughts on amusement parks you'd like to share, please, by all means, share them. Join us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at NPRPCHH. We will be right back with our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week.
Support for this podcast comes from TNT with Public Morals, a new series set in 1960s New York. Here is creator Edward Burns describing the Public Morals Division.
These cops work in public morals, and public morals is what typically would be called today the Vice Division. Back then, they referred to these crimes as victimless crimes, primarily dealt with gambling, prostitution, and anything to do with alcohol and the blue laws.
Watch Public Morals series premiere Tuesday, August 25th at 10, 9 Central. Only on TNT.
All right, it is time for our favorite and final segment of Pop Culture Happy Hour, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Margaret H. Willison, I'm going to start with you. What is making you happy this week?
So, what's making me happiest this week is Waitress the Musical, which is in previews at the American Repertory Theater in Cambridge. And it is a world premiere musical based on the 2007 movie by Adrian Shelley. The score is by Sarah Bareilles, who's a reasonably famous pop star. And, you know, I like her pop music. Okay, I sing along to it when it comes on the radio, but I don't own any of her albums. But she took to writing this particular musical and to writing the score of a musical so well. It's a great match between material and songs and song style. And it's such a lovely story, and the performers are amazing. So, obviously, if you're not in the greater Boston area, it's going to be a challenge to get here. But if you can get here, do come here. Come see it. And if not, it's going to go to Broadway and win a ton of Tonys. Nice. Because that's what happens with stuff from the ART when it's not garbage like Finding Neverland. don't go see
Gauntlet
that. It's very bad.
Down.
But do go see Waitress. Come to Boston and see it, or wait for it to come to New York. Because it's wonderful.
That's the thing with theater recommendations. It's like, file it away for later.
Well, and then a more general one, Playing House, the sitcom on USA, just came back for its second season. If you are a lucky person with a cable subscription, you can watch all of season one on demand, which is what I've been doing at the house I'm cat sitting at. and it is phenomenal. It's one of the best sitcoms of all time.
Wow.
Best friends raising a baby together, basically. But it's just incredibly funny. If you like Parks and Recreation and other warm TV shows like that, or even if you like Difficult People, you should give it a shot. Very similar feminine comic sensibility, and it's really been making my week. You can also get all of season one on Amazon for $10. So definitely check that out. It's great.
So it's great if you like Parks and Recreation or Difficult People.
Mm-hmm.
Those are two different shows.
Glenn, you'll back me up on this.
I do back her up. It's great.
Wonderful. All
great
right.
Great cast, too.
Great cast. Keegan-Michael Key. Mm-hmm. Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parnham. And you might remember Jessica St. Clair and Lennon Parnham from their very short-lived NBC sitcom, Best Friends Forever.
Mm-hmm.
But if you remember them from that, then you're already watching Playing House.
Yep.
Nice. All right. Thank you, Margaret H. Willison. Gene Demby, what is making you happy this week?
I wanted to signal boost a book that the great Barry Hardiman shouted out not long ago, Loving Day. She shouted out before it came out. I just finished it this weekend on a long plane trip. It was amazing. It makes my antenna twitch in all the ways. It's set in Philadelphia. It's about race. It's big-hearted. It's really sarcastic. It's like all of the things that I would want in a novel. It's really, really smart and really funny. It's by Matt Johnson. He wrote Pym. He does graphic novels. He's just a really, really smart dude. This is a book about a bunch of stuff about identity, but it's not like, it's not, it doesn't sound, it's like, oh, it's a book about identity. Like, oh, God. It's not that book.
It's not homework.
Right, it's not homework at all. It's a really, really funny, unnerving, smart novel. I was just in my feelings when I was reading it a lot. So I'm glad it exists in the world. I just want to signal boost that. And there are two albums that I wanted to shout out. One is from a group called Hiatus Coyote, which is a Australian neo-soul.
Yeah, neo-soul.
I mean, I don't know how you describe them, but they sound like peak Erykah Badu. Mm-hmm. And I remember my girlfriend came in the apartment one day. She's like, is this Erica? And I was like, no, it's these white kids from Australia. And she was like, really, word? I'm like, yeah, I know. It's a really, really dope album. And the other album I wanted to shout out was by The Internet. They have an album called Ego Death. The Internet is from the collective that brought us Frank Ocean and Tyler, the Creator, and Earl Sweatshirt and all those crazy people. A soul album that sounds like, again, like peak acid jazz, neo soul, like the best of that. I bet this was wrong. Make you feel nice and comfortable. Trying to act nice, girl, your cover's long. But you already know. I was joking with someone on Twitter the other day, but they're like the two best R&B albums of the last year, and they're from places you would never expect them to come from.
Yeah.
But they're really, really dope, and you should check it out.
Great. Yeah. The Internet, Hiatus Coyote, and the book Loving Day.
Loving Day, yep.
Nice. Thank you, Gene Demby. Mm-hmm. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
Back in the early 80s when you would play computer games by hooking a hamster up to your computer. It was crude, unbelievably crude graphics. There was a computer series called King's Quest, which were basically fantasy things where you had to pick up everything not nailed down and use it to do something. And then you'd solve puzzles and you'd get to the game. And when there was a moment when there was some animation on screen, it felt like you were just like... going into that 2001 monolith at the end, like God, it's full of stars. They have just released a indie publisher called The Odd Gentleman reached out to the people who made the King's Quest series back in the day. It was an outfit called Sierra. It's no longer around. And got not only permission, but also instructions on how to, you know, structure the game. Here's what we had in our head when we were designing games like this. And it's great. King's Quest has just been released by The Odd Gentleman for Xbox and PlayStation, and I'm sure for computers as well. It's incredibly well designed. It's incredibly gorgeous. It is not difficult at all. It is very rudimentary. It's great for kids, I suppose. It's just very simple puzzle solving with dragons and a guy going on a quest and a magic mirror, and it's everything you want. Little shout outs from the series if you played it back in the day. King's Quest, downloadable now.
Thank you, Glenn Weldon. So I've just got a few little things. First of all, a great hire was made or announced today, being Monday when we're taping this. James Poniewozik from Time has just been named the New York Times TV critic.
Oh, awesome!
Yes. Oh, wow.
That is if you follow him on Twitter, if you read his stuff, the first thing that springs immediately to mind is I might actually have to get a New York Times digital subscription now. He's so good. He's really funny on Twitter and in his writing. He's just a lively, terrific, terrific writer. I'm so happy for him. I'm happy for the New York Times. It's a great move, great hire. Wanted to shout out a Twitter feed for those who don't know about it. It's certainly one that takes this building by storm roughly several times a day. I think you know where I'm going with this.
Yep.
NPR Armageddon, which is just like a couple of dudes who Photoshop NPR and other public media personalities' heads onto the bodies of warriors in post-apocalyptic thrillers. So they'll take sort of a Mad Maxian body, any sort of apocalyptic-looking action hero, and then graft, say, Susan Stamberg's head on top of it. Some of them work better than others. Some of them are beautiful. And just last week, NPR Music got its third entry in the NPR Armageddon series. We had already had Bob Boylan and Felix Contreras, and last week they decided to do Katie Presley.
Is that why she has her hands over her face right now?
Yeah, she was, who is sitting in the booth with her hands over her face, embarrassed. She has been contributing to All Songs Considered for several months now. She writes.
She's great.
She writes all over the NPR music site.
She's awesome.
And in the interest of full disclosure, is my live-in girlfriend. The first member of our household to be honored by NPR Armageddon. If you
hint,
are not
hint, hint.
If you are not following NPR Armageddon, it's just the way it's spelled, at NPR Armageddon. Finally, I did want to throw out just a little note about the end of The Daily Show.
Mm-hmm.
We have certainly talked about The Daily Show at great length, but I wanted to call out a specific moment of the very long, very warm finale of The Daily Show, which I thought as a viewing experience was kind of up and down. I was not as enamored of the speech at the end, which mm-hmm. felt very much like a Will McAvoy lecture on, mm-hmm. the, on the newsroom.
Yep.
But the moment that they give over to Stephen Colbert,
yep.
where Colbert
always
just...
the best moment.
It's the best moment of that show. And Colbert just leans in and just talks about what kind of impact Jon Stewart has had on the careers of the people who have worked on The Daily Show. And that's a very large group over the course of 16 and a half years. And it is this wonderful expression of warmth and sincerity and kindness that I found jarring in the best possible way.
You are a great artist and a good man, and personally, I do not know how this son of a poor Appalachian turd miner, I do not know what I would do if you hadn't brought me on this show. I'd be back in those hills mining turds with Pappy. John, you know by now I'd have dung lung.
You're
okay, so John, and it's almost over.
All right.
I know you are not asking for this, but yes. On behalf of so many people whose lives you changed over the past 16 years, thank you. And now,
yes.
I believe your line, and correct me if I'm wrong,
yes.
is, we'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the show at NPRPCHH. You can follow me at I Dislike Stephen. That's STEPHEN. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GHWeldon. That's WELDON. You can follow Gene Demby at GD215. That's GEEDEE215. And you can follow Margaret H. Willison at Mrs. Friday Next. You can follow our producer, Jessica Reedy, at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director, Mike Katz. Katzif at Mike Katzif, that's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you all for listening, and we will see you back here next week.
Summer is almost over and great music is in the air. All Songs Considered is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Each week, Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best of the best new and upcoming music with lots of songs you'll fall in love with. Find new All Songs episodes every Tuesday at npr.org/podcasts and on the NPR One app.